KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
My goal is to, in the healthcare committee, listen to everyone and give everybody opportunities to make their decisions, have conversations about them, and try to work together.
When you look at some of the most significant 20th century or 21st century artists, American artists, most of them will cite Dr. Seuss as a major influence on them.
There is in Mexico an extraordinary criminal threat. Something very strange has happened in Mexico in recent years that we have to try and understand.
Yon Grillo on Mexico and El Narco, the movement of drug cartels. Dr. Seuss's artistic influence. Most artists cite Dr. Seuss. We'll find out more about that. State Senator Randy Becker is serving on the healthcare committee. We start, though, with what's happening with the Boeing 787, the Dreamliner. Following a fire aboard an all-Nippon Airlines Dreamliner earlier this week, the FAA has issued an emergency airworthiness directive grounding the Boeing 787 in the U.S. And though it so far only applies to United Airlines, the only U.S. carrier with the Dreamliner in its fleet, the European Aviation Safety Agency has endorsed the directive, and that decision grounds two 787s operated by LOT Polish Airlines. So what does this mean for the technology behind the Dreamliner, and how are they going to resolve the problem? Guy Norris is senior editor of Aviation Week. He reports and has written about the Dreamliner. He is the author of Boeing 787 Dreamliner, co-authored with Mark Wagner, a book about the plane. So you wrote the book on this plane, Guy Norris. I assume you've been looking at it for a while.
Yes, good morning. Yes, it's obviously, this is a tremendous sort of setback, as it were, at this stage of the program. The development obviously had taken a lot longer than anybody had expected or hoped for, and having got the aircraft into service, to see this sort of problem emerge into its initial phase of service life, it's very unsettling and a troubling time for the program.
Now, the FAA was worried about that lithium battery for a few years now. It's looked at it and raised questions about it. How did they approve it? Why did they approve it with those questions?
Yes, the FAA, of course, the whole emphasis of the 787 program is towards a more efficient a low fuel burn aircraft, so that part of this drive is to increase the amount of electrical use in the systems. So therefore, when Boeing was looking at how to do this, it had to broach, you know, go into new territory which had never been explored before technically. And it was thought that the time was right, that the technology was sufficiently mature to introduce this. The FAA, as you rightly say, did sort of say, well, hang on a minute. We don't actually have anything in our rules which really sufficiently covers this. So what we'll have to do is introduce a special set of conditions which you, Boeing, have to agree to do in order to agree that we can certify this. And those special provisions were, in fact, all these extra safeguards which were introduced, obviously, as part of the system and within the battery itself. The FAA agreed to that, and Boeing developed it, they tested it, developed it, and showed that it complied with the FAA's requirements at that time. And yet, obviously, as we've seen, there's nothing like true service life to show that no matter what sort of precautions sometimes you take, people are in for surprises.
The FAA in 2007, they issued this notice of proposed special conditions like you talk about. They noticed that the batteries are significantly more susceptible to internal failures that can result in self-sustaining increases in temperature and pressure, so thermal runaway.
Right.
More than their nickel cadmium or lead acid counterparts. They said that they were, in particular, they were worried about overcharging, which could result in a self-sustaining fire or explosion. Do we know that that's what's going on now, or is it still uncertain what's happening?
Yeah, from the little information we've been getting, it seems that the likelihood is that it was more of an overcharging situation. And we're saying that because more information came out about the less serious incident with ANA. I mean, I'm saying it was less serious because, of course, it didn't actually end in a conflagration. However, the indications on the ground are that it was approaching that overheating situation. Also, the indications are that the system generally handled it as well, can be taken as a crumb of comfort from this situation for Boeing. But the bottom line is that no real hard facts have yet emerged outside of the investigation, and that we're still a little bit in the dark as far as the detail of what actually has been going on with the battery malfunctions.
Guy Norris is senior editor of Aviation Week. He's been covering the evolution of the Dreamliner 787. When you say the system somewhat functioned properly, is there operator error involved in running this system possibly? Is it about overcharging that individuals that are maintaining the plane are engaged in, or is this all automatic?
Yeah, and it's all an automated system. And what may be one of the theories that's been bandied around is that the overcharging aspect of it is the area which seems to be a focus for the investigation, because if you look at the failure scenarios, the one which doesn't at least match the little known evidence that we on the outside have been given, it would indicate at least to the outside world that it's the overcharging that could be the most, it is the center of an investigation. That, of course, is part of a totally automated process, so it's not operator error or anything like that. The other potential, and of course this could be relevant to the production batches involved in the batteries that were put on these particular aircraft, is that there's some sort of manufacturing flaw, which statistically is a very low possibility or probability that you know, would be a factor, but nonetheless, a manufacturing flaw could be one of the reasons that could account for this sort of thing happening.
You know, grounding a new airplane, it hasn't happened in the U.S. since the DC-10 in 1979. New aircraft do have issues that have to be worked out, but the FAA is saying it wants a corrective action plan. So what does that look like, and how long could, what kind of process could Boeing be looking at?
Right. Well, yeah, that's a very good question. I think that the key thing here is for Boeing is that it's looking back and looking at its development track record and saying, why didn't this happen? Why didn't we see any of this happening in the test and development of the system and of the aircraft? That could be a key part of the investigation and immediately impact the corrective action plan, because that would help them understand whether, for example, it was a manufacturing flaw specific to these particular batteries, in which case it's more of a case of tactically one-off, you know, sort of applying lessons learned and finding suspect batteries, replacing them. Or a more serious case is that it's a more generic systems failure of some sort. The overcharging, preventative measures are not working as planned in service, and therefore they have to readdress major aspects of the safety, the safety provisions they've put into this. Or worst case scenario, I think for them is that they have to completely take out this type of battery and go for an earlier, sort of more heavier but equivalent power system to replace the lithium ion.
Wow, that could negate the very thing that they were trying to use as a selling point, a fuel-efficient plane.
It would dent it slightly, but it really wouldn't, in the big scheme of things, make that much of a difference from the efficiency perspective. The weight aspect is, in the small numbers there, very much just in the noise. The issue there is that can you get an equivalent level of charging and the sort of electrical characteristics that you wanted from lithium ion, which made it the most attractive at that time to them anyway. You know, can you get that from a conventional battery system? And by and large, the answer seems to be yes. It's simply now, it would be a question, therefore, of having to design and implement, test, certify a replacement battery system. But, you know, again, this is all speaking very much in advance of the reality of the investigation, which, you know, I'm simply not privy to.
Right. No, we are all operating partially in the dark here, aren't we?
No, unfortunately, yes.
The Boeing, as the company's delivered 50 Dreamliners, they have orders for another 800. Have you heard from any of your sources? Are buyers getting panicky? Are they looking at, we've already heard about some people wanting some compensation, lot airlines, but are buyers of planes coming getting panicky?
From what we're hearing so far, it's very much a wait and see attitude. You know, a lot of these are experienced airline buyers. They know that they see this sort of situation not quite so dramatically, I have to say, but they see a lot of, you know, teething trouble periods for aircraft, and I think that they know Boeing has a handle on, you know, will get a handle on this pretty quickly. If there are any sort of knee-jerk reactions, it would just be from some customers who might, you know, want to make a make a little bit of an opportunity out of this. But by and large, we don't really see any big kickback right now.
All right. You started your book with an introduction. The story of the 787 defies the imagination. I guess it continues to do that even as it comes to ground. I appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Boeing 787 Dreamliner, Guy Norris co-wrote with Mark Wagner. Guy Norris is senior editor at Aviation Week. We'll continue to track Boeing's questions and answers as the story unfolds. This is Weekday.
Thirty-one and foggy in Seattle. Forecast calls for sun later and a high of 41.
Hello again, I'm Warren Alney. On the next To the Point, next week's Israeli elections may bring in an administration more conservative than the current one. What will a new coalition mean for the region, the two-state solution, and relations with the United States? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
This morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Maria Semple's Where'd You Go, Bernadette?, a novel about parenting, privilege, and life in Seattle.
I'm Bernard Bullett. It's 9:17. Coming soon to Seattle, a new production of Anton Chekhov's The Seagull. The show was put together in a somewhat unusual way. KUOW's Marcy Silman will tell us more in about a half an hour.
Salvado de una muerte segurita, con puro cuerno de chivo, me han tirado de cerquita, 118 balazos, y Diosito me los quita. La primera fue en mi casa, me quisieron secuestrar, pero no dejé agarrarme, me empiezan a
That's a corrido. Corrido. My Spanish is not that good, but our guest is very good. 118 Bullets, one of the songs sung in Mexico about the El Narco culture. From the Mexican mountains, where pot and poppies are grown, all the way to the streets of Mexican cities. More than 55,000 now, about, soldiers, police officers, drug traffickers, citizens have died in Mexico's drug war. Journalist Yon Grillo, I was saying Grillo, but Grillo, says the drug trade known as El Narco is a cultural movement, a has transformed Mexico and maybe America at some point, too. Juan Grillo's book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. He's a journalist, writer, TV producer. He's been covering Latin America since 2001. He's been our guest a couple of times on the show. He's been on Time Magazine, CNN, Reuters, PBS NewsHour, Al Jazeera English. Lots. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to be here.
It's good to talk to you. So 118 balazos. You wrote about that corrido.
Yeah, corrido.
Corrido.
You wrote the ballad, a ballad. Yeah, it's a ballad by Valentin Elizalde, known as the Golden Rooster. And it talks about a man who survived 118 bullets. Obviously, it's a kind of fantasy song, somebody surviving 118 bullets in three different assassination attempts. But this Valentin himself was assassinated coming after he played a concert in northern Mexico. And his cousin, who was next to him in the vehicle, also survived 7 bullets. And I interviewed his cousin after that shooting, and he talked about, you know, the memory of the Golden Rooster and of playing in that musical scene.
Why was he assassinated? The speculation about why
well,
he was assassinated?
They arrested somebody, and they accused the person publicly, and the person who they arrested was linked to the Zetas drug cartel. And he, Valentin, was from Sinaloa, and some people said he was closer to the Sinaloa cartel of drug traffickers.
You know, I wanted to start there and ask you about this, because you write that El Narco is cultural. It is embedded in some parts of Mexico. Is it different from how we might look at some of the more violent gangster rap that came out in America? Is it substantially a different cultural movement? Like, are the corridos linked to the drug dealers in a more entwined way?
They are, yes. I mean, one thing about the cartels are very powerful organizations and very broad organizations. And they do have, and this has to be understood, they do have deep roots in these communities. You know, we can't just say the problem, you know, it's a couple of bad guys. They do have strong support in areas. And that's one of the reasons why they can't be beaten. Because when the military goes into these neighborhoods, often kids on the street will be phoning up the cartels to tell them on which block the military is and so forth. Now, the cartels actually pay artists to write songs about them. They actually give them sometimes $10,000 to write a ballad about them. And often people in the communities refer to them as valientes, or brave ones, which gives a kind of sign of how they're seen by many people.
Even though their people are losing their brothers and sisters, their sons and daughters to these people.
That's right. And in recent years, you have seen these the violence from these drug cartels turn into a national tragedy. I mean, really has been very sad, the loss. And that has turned many people against them. You have many sad stories of innocent people. One mother I was talking to was in her home when an armed group linked to a drug cartel stormed in. They forced the whole family to lay on the floor, and they asked her which of her sons was the eldest. And her eldest son raised his hand. He was an 18-year-old philosophy student, just beginning his degree, and they took him away. And she never saw him since. And that's the kind of, you know, devastating things that this violence can mean for communities around Mexico.
I recommend that anybody looking up El Narco does not do a Google search on the image section, because the stuff that's posted is brutally gruesome. And it's bragging rights, it's threats. What are these guys, mostly, right, guys saying to each other with these images and these actions?
It's a very good question. And people often write about the violence itself, and that big question is why? You know, why the violence seems so incomprehensible. Why do they throw 5 human heads into a disco dance floor? Why do they leave? And this was a thing I covered a few months ago in Mexico. They left 49 bodies on a road, all decapitated, all with their hands and feet cut off. So the question is why? And I think to understand what their motivations are, you have to look at how this conflict has developed. it changed around 2004, 2005 from being gang members and gang violence like we know in the United States to a low-intensity war with paramilitary groups. Many of them were formerly in the Mexican military. Some were mercenaries from the Guatemalan military who had fought in the war against leftist guerrillas there back in the 1980s and 1990s. Now, back in that war, they would use terror as a way of control of territory. So they would cut heads off in front of villages as a way of controlling territory. How do we shock and scare the population into not fighting against us? So when these people work for cartels, they started thinking like that. How do we control the territory? How do we get this place? We use terror. And it becomes almost like a game of high-stakes poker where these different cartels are always raising the stakes. If you kill five of my guys, I'll kill 15 of yours. If you kill five policemen, I'm going to kill 15 and show that I'm the toughest gangster in town.
You write about the history of drugs in El Narco, Yo El Grillo, and I want to start. Let's go back to how poppies got to Mexico, because it was a long time ago.
It was, yes. Opium poppies were first taken to Mexico at the end of the 19th century by Chinese workers, Chinese laborers.
They were there for agriculture and railroads?
Railroads and mines.
Railroads and mines.
Mostly. And of the Chinese, there's a lot of opium in China, thanks to Britain as well, thanks to my country, Britain, fighting the opium wars to keep our monopoly of selling opium to Chinese people. Back in the 19th century, in some ways, the British Navy was the first drug cartel, or the first enforcers for the drug cartel back then. And so the Chinese immigrants would bring poppies with them, and they planted them in the state of Sinaloa in the northwest of Mexico, where they took root very well in that climate. And then when opium was made illegal back in 1914 in the Harrison's Narcotics Tax Act, which first created the black market in the United States for opium, and Chinese Mexicans would often sell them to Chinese Americans. And there's some big cases back then in the early 20th century documented of that trade.
And the people who lived in those towns and cities and mountains where the Chinese Mexicans were growing opium, those people had their own history of rebellion and they weren't conquered. Didn't you say at one point that the Spanish said, "Oh, those people are cannibals. They're so violent." But they were a people that were sort of an unconquered group of peoples.
That's right, and that's interesting. I think a lot of the time, all these organized crime movements emerge in places where the state is weak, where power is weak, and that's the same in Sicily or in Medellin, Colombia. And in the case of Sinaloa, it was a place where the Spanish struggled to conquer, and there was some. Whereas they conquered the Aztec Empire, they found it very hard to fight these indigenous people. And some of them had some important defeats of the Spaniards. And if you go to Sinaloa today, the people will proudly say, when the Spanish came, they were eaten. They get some cannibals there. So again, it's hard to look at how historically true that is. You know, people say things, but it's interesting they have that with these Spanish scare stories that have now become kind of popular folklore. Or was it true? But it was interesting. It's a place that was hard to conquer. A place that later there was a lot of bandits and so forth. And then later these same people took over the drug trade.
Because they saw the Chinese Mexicans making all this money and they decided they were going to take it over. If they weren't part of it, they were going to take it.
That's right. And there was actually, this happened as a wave of racial violence against Chinese in Mexico back in the 1930s that's been documented. And that's something very sad, kind of forgotten by many historians, by many people, but remembered by historians. How many people would see these Chinese businesses and there were groups who would abduct the Chinese, put them on rail cars and take them out of the state. And I quote one public official who was, as a young man, involved in these anti-Chinese riots and kind of later regretted it, but said it was kind of a real mob feeling then. And in the same time, they took over the opium trade and the heroin trade, and that became the El Narco in its early days.
Now, you also write that later... There is this, you couldn't find the facts behind it, but there is this notion that the U.S. in the 40s I guess even the 20s, but later in the 40s, the U.S. would look the other way because they wanted, they needed the opium. They needed it to just get medicines to the soldiers. And so they allowed this traffic to go back and forth across the border.
Yeah, this is this big conspiracy theory in a way. Though in Sinaloa, almost every official will say this is the case. And journalists at the time looked at this, that opium was needed to make into morphine to help soldiers in the Second World War. By the campaign of submarines in the Atlantic cut off, and of boats there, cut off the traditional source, which was turkey. So they turned a blind eye on it coming from Mexico. There was a letter written to the U.S. Drug Commissioner, I believe it, at the time, and he denies it stringently, this happened. But it's something which is believed by many people.
These groups in the 40s and 50s and 60s are not the same groups that operate today, or did they grow from those groups?
They grew from those groups. And I think, again, to understand the strength of El Narco being the collective word for all of the Mexican drug traffickers, is their deep roots in these communities. If you have a village like some of these villages in the Sierra Madre Mountains, you have families who have been involved in trafficking drugs since the 1930s. So you have people who can say their granddad, their great granddad, was involved in this business, as many uncles and so forth, and that has brought wealth to their communities and been the principal source of wealth for these communities for so many generations, which again explains why local people support them rather than supporting the Mexican government attacking them.
When the PRI was voted out of power, the PRI had a sort of I forget how you called it, but basically they were a political mafia, and they controlled the country. So there were arrangements made. Everybody paid everybody else off in a way that people could do business relatively easily. And then that fell apart. The drug war comes about from Vicente Fox, and that's when this El Narco morphs, transforms.
Yeah, that's right. They say with the PRI, money went up like gas and power flowed down like water. It was a system, where if the local people paid off the local police chief, or gangsters paid off the local police chief, who could pay off the state police chief, who could pay off the governor, who could pay off the president. And so there was a way of bribes, but historians also said it was like an oil and glue which made the system tick over. It kept things going, it kept things in line. Because the government was controlling it, they could say, okay, we don't want any gangster who's going to carry out too many killings. Keep this a low-profile thing, just move your drugs. Now, what happened in 2000, when I first arrived in Mexico, you have Vicente Fox, who was a president from a different party after 71 years. So a time of optimism, a time of celebration. But the system of corruption fell apart. And you had different police forces controlled by different political parties. And in some cases, they would actually actively fight each other. Like there's one case documented of a group of hitmen went to attack a federal police base. They attacked the base and went away in a Mitsubishi van, and they got a punctured tire. So they phoned the state police, who came and gave them a ride to a Walmart store, actually, where they got picked up by a taxi. So the state police were helping these hitmen attack the federal police. They were both controlled by different political parties and, not on the same side.
All right, so where are we today with El Narco? We have a new pre-president in power. Is it any different than it was 3 years ago?
Yeah, we've now seen these... This is the last 5 years of horrific violence, of a real national tragedy. Mass graves, 300 corpses, a single massacre with 72 people, a casino that got burned down, killing 62 people. Very, very sad things. As well as the more than 55,000 murdered as a direct result of this violence, you have thousands have disappeared. And that's very hard. No closure for families to know where their loved ones are. So now we have a government who's come in and said, this war against them hasn't been working. This idea of you know, we can destroy organized crime has not borne fruit. It's just creating more violence. So this government now, of the PRI again, have said we have to change the objectives. Our objectives now have to be, our priorities have to be to reduce violence, reduce extortion, reduce kidnapping. What do Mexican people most care about? Do they most care about drug traffickers being arrested and tons of drugs being on the scales? Or do they care about less shootouts on their street, about less shootouts outside the schools of their children? And I think, you know, they've hit the public mood there. They've now announced a 6-point plan to try and reduce violence, and that's been signed on by all three major political parties. And the first point is a national plan of prevention of crime, which they want to mean, meaning going to these neighborhoods and addressing the young men who join the cartels. I think that's a very good thing, a very important thing, because I've been in these neighborhoods and seen how teenagers are recruited to work for the cartels, often starting as the spies, like, say, standing on the corner with a cell phone, calling up the cartel at any time a police car comes past.
What does that mean for the big market to the north? What does it mean for America? You know, there's this fear that Mexico was going to disintegrate. Also a fear that the Zetas and the Sinaloa cartels will move into the states in a more obvious way.
I think the United States needs to take the situation in Mexico very seriously. I think it was sad how in the presidential debate, Mexico was not even mentioned. Considering that the United States supports the Mexican military with billions of dollars and hardware like Black Hawk helicopters, how American agents have been murdered in Mexico in recent years, how there's an attack on CIA agents, how there's a lot of refugees in the United States who have got political asylum because they've run from either the Mexican military or the cartels, and judges have granted them political asylum. So, and because of the United States supports the cartels through buying drugs, or consumers of drugs support the cartels, and gun sellers in the United States support the cartels. So it's definitely an issue the United States, you know, really needs to take seriously and to look at and to say, well, really, are these kind of groups and this kind of violence is not healthy in our neighborhood.
All right, so one of the reasons you're in Washington State is because of the legalization of marijuana. Do you have a sense of how that affects cartels and their business up here or their actions up here?
This vote to legalize marijuana in Washington State was historic. It was a global landmark, because nowhere in the world has fully legalized marijuana before. Even Amsterdam, you know, we all think of with the coffee shops and everything, is still only tolerated. So what voters did on November the 6th was something with global implications rippling across into Mexico right now. A change, a sea change in how we could approach the war on drugs. Now, in the long term, if marijuana became legal in a good part of the United States and in Mexico could quite easily say, well, if it's legal in California, Washington State, Colorado, why are we burning marijuana fields? Why are we having gunfights with people growing marijuana here? If it was legal in large parts of the United States and Mexico, that would take billions of dollars away from these cartels. And the Mexican military have not been able to do that. The DEA have not been able to do that. They could really damage their finances or make it so some of these farmers who have been growing marijuana for decades are not part of the cartels. The cartel area of business is reduced.
It's hard to believe they would accept that, the cartels.
Well, the cartels obviously are involved in a bunch of rackets. They're also selling cocaine, trafficking cocaine, which is, you know, obviously a very big money earner. They're also trafficking crystal meth. They're also trafficking heroin. And as well as that, they now moved into a whole bunch of other businesses, even stealing oil from the Mexican oil industry. They go to the pipelines, they plug in a tube, and they suck it out. So a whole bunch of things. And there's obviously an issue it has to be dealt with in a bunch of ways, and some of that response can be military. I think the Mexican government has got the right to use lethal force against these groups. But at the same time, if they lost billions of dollars, there'll be an easier threat for the government forces to deal with, whether they accepted it or not.
Yon Grillo's book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, there's a lot here that we didn't touch on. You, sir, stay safe covering this story, because it is a hard story. And boy, some of the stories in here, I worry for you.
Well, thank you. Always do try to keep safe down there. And it's a hard story, but a story of definitely of important international significance. And we'll see what happens in and how this legalization of marijuana, I mean, maybe plays out and is part of the solution in the long term. You know, we'll see if that works out.
El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgents, Yon Grillo. This is Weekday. So we're going to go out with one more corrido from the Grupo Cartel. El Alamo es zambada, Joaquín Guzmán de la Tuna, de la Noria el Güero Palema, Nachito es de Potrerillos, Fernández de Tierra Blanca.
It's 31 degrees in Seattle with lots of fog. Forecast says should be mostly sunny this afternoon, and we expect to reach 41 degrees.
KUOW and the Nordic Heritage Museum present the Nordic Lights Film Festival, highlighting contemporary feature-length and short films from Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden, January 18th through the 20th at SIF Cinema at the Film Center. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Radioactive is a program where youth producers tell stories and learn about behind the scenes of public radio.
I feel like I said that wrong.
Radioactive Spring Workshop starts in February and is open to youth ages 16 to 18. Apply by January 21st at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Bach and Telemann on January 18th and 19th at Benaroya Hall, featuring Handel's Overture from the Occasional Oratorio, Telemann's Wassermusik, and J.S. Bach's Suite for Orchestra No. 4. Tickets at seattlesymphony.org.
942, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
All right, and now we're going to turn to Dr. Seuss. So maybe you think that's crazy. But sometimes that's how things work out, from the Mexico drug cartels to Dr. Seuss. Maybe you need a little breather.
Perhaps we should have planned it differently.
2 decades after his death, Dr. Seuss is still a best-selling author, but he also is an artist. Now, Katie Sewell, you talked to somebody who's been tracking the art of Dr. Seuss.
I did. Bob Chase. He's the editor and publisher behind a new book called The Cat Behind the Hat, The Art of Dr. Seuss, which is focusing on the work that he did that he called the Midnight Paintings, ones that he did with a cocktail in his hand and hid behind a bookcase because he didn't want anyone to ever see them until after his death. So to start our interview, I asked him, was Dr. Seuss as whimsical in person as his drawings seemed to indicate he would be?
He was. You know, the interesting thing about Seuss is that he was sort of practical joking. For him was kind of a lifelong passion. So it was more than just what he did for his profession. It was serious fun for him and everything that he did. So he used practical joking and having fun throughout his life.
Why did he start writing and drawing for children?
I think he had seen the sort of state of affairs with children's books when he first began writing. And, you know, the children's book world was really kind of riddled with this Dick and Jane sort of mentality, which in many ways was talking down to children rather than sort of talking with them and bringing them along in the fun. And for him, he was a child at heart. You know, further to your first question, you know, was he fun? Yes. And he was a child at heart. And so I think he felt that he really could make a contribution to the children's book world by imbuing that sort of fun and excitement into the world of children's books.
I know that you worked with his wife in putting this book together. What is she like as a person?
She's fantastic. I mean, she is absolutely the living legacy of Dr. Seuss. So she's an amazing woman in that everything that happens in the world of Seuss passes across her desk. I was lucky enough to meet her about 10 years ago, and we've been working very closely to together for that period of time. And I'm always impressed by her dedication to the legacy of Dr. Seuss and what he wanted for his legacy. So and she's fun, so she has that as well.
What did he want for his legacy?
As far as this side of his legacy, which is kind of the art side of it, I think that he really hoped that his work would achieve some sort of recognition in sort of the art world. I mean, he believed that the work that's highlighted in this book is significant. It's very surreal in nature. It stretches far beyond what he did for the children's books. And although he was concerned with sort of facing the criticism that might come his way during his lifetime in showing these works, which is really the reason why he didn't show the works while he was alive, since his passing, he wanted the world to see it and to kind of take notice of him in this other light. And so the legacy really is that he's kind of taking his place alongside Norman Rockwell and then, in sort of the broad sense, and then fine artists in a more specific sense by hanging in galleries and museums next to those prominent figures.
Do you think it's difficult for artists who work on children's books or things that are aimed towards children in general to be considered credible in the art world?
It's probably more of a challenge. The art world is finicky. There's many different levels and lots of gatekeepers and tastemakers and whatnot. So it can be tricky, and I do think that in some cases it can be an uphill battle. But if you look at folks like Tim Burton, who has certainly crossed over. He just opened a major exhibition at MoMA in New York. You know, that starts to say that, these kinds of crossovers are possible. And even more interesting than that is when you look at some of the most significant 20th century or 21st century artists, American artists, most of them will cite Dr. Seuss as a major influence on them, Tim Burton being one of them. But any significant pop artist or post-pop artist that I meet always cites Seuss as a major influence.
Do you have a sense of who would have been an influence on Dr. Seuss?
I think probably the biggest influence on Dr. Seuss, quite frankly, was his upbringing and kind of the access to his father was a zookeeper. He was actually a superintendent of the parks, but as part of that in Springfield, Massachusetts, he literally was the zookeeper. So Seuss had this unfettered access to all of these animals and interactions with animals, which clearly had an impact on him. Now, that's something that translates all the way through. On the art side of it, it's surrealism. 100%. Seuss was actually in Paris at the start of the Surrealist movement and we have documentation that he was in and around the city at the very moment when some of those first exhibitions were staged and then again in New York. So it's without question a massive influence on him is Surrealism. And when you look even at the children's book drawings, you'll see, although there's fun and whimsical and all of that, they have this sort of underpinning of surrealism.
I'm speaking with Bob Chase, who's the editor and publisher of The Cat Behind the Hat, The Art of Dr. Seuss, about the other artistic works that Dr. Seuss did beyond his children's books. So some of the art in this book has never been seen by the public before in a mass-released form or outside of a gallery. What would surprise us about how the paintings in the book are compared to what we're familiar with?
I think people will be surprised and just taken with the breadth of his talent. When you look at the paintings that are in the book, your first reaction is these are somehow related to Dr. Seuss. They have what I call a very Seussian quality to them, but they stretch much farther than that. Again, the surrealism comes in. This is Dr. Seuss in many cases sort of for adults. I mean, he made these paintings at night when he would shut down the studio and have a few cocktails and just relax and begin to work on things for his own pleasure rather than commercial deadlines and whatnot. So these have that sort of feeling. They are Seuss, but clearly with an adult palette. The other thing that people are going to be absolutely surprised by is there's sculptures in here, there's paintings, there's drawings, and all of the work that he did privately relates directly to the work that he did in the children's books. You can draw a very clear line across all of this material and see how consistent he was as an artist. Some were just more fully developed than others. But that's one of the most fascinating things to me is how consistent he was as an artist.
And there seems to be, at least to me, I remember as a child reading it, there does seem to be sort of a dark underpinning to some of his drawings or themes. Do you find that to be true?
I think he was unafraid of hitting issues sort of head on. Many people don't know, and it's highlighted in this book, that he had two very big careers before he even wrote his first children's book. The first was as an ad man doing advertising illustrations, and then he became a very prominent editorial cartoonist. And where he really honed his skills was when he was an editorial cartoonist for PM Magazine during the war years, and he made a series of 400 political cartoons about the war. And he pulled no punches. I mean, he just hit issues directly head on. And I think he continued that through the children's books. But in this book, you can see that correlation as well.
This book is about his art, but do you take into consideration his writing and how important his writing style was to his success?
Yes. I mean, the writing is an absolute, sort of goes hand in hand with the art. So it's a huge contributor to his success. And even when you look at the private paintings in this book, the titles of those paintings are so fantastic and so encapsulate sort of Sousa's writing, you know, talent as well, that, again, you see that consistency through it all as well. He makes up names. He has sculptures called the Andalusian Grackler and the Two-Horned Druberhannes. He just made things up that didn't exist before. And then the titles of the paintings are just, they're phenomenal.
And as you learned more about Ted Geisel, who was Dr. Seuss's real name, what was surprising to you?
Well, I think it goes to what I find about most artists. I do a lot of work with living artists and with artist estates. And in some ways it was surprising, in some ways not, to find that Seuss had the same sort of insecurities that plagues many incredibly successful artists. In 1957, he wrote The Cat in the Hat and The Grinch, two of the biggest children's books of all time. And he panicked after releasing those two books and thought, how could he ever top that? And he actually painted a painting, which is in his book, called Self-Portrait of the Artist Worrying About His Next Book. And he's terrified. What is he going to do next? The next thing he does is Green Eggs and Ham. It becomes the third largest selling book in the English language, though.
Bob Chase is the editor and publisher of The Cat Behind the Hat, The Art of Dr. Seuss. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
You got it. Thanks. Great to be here.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell.
2 years ago, a group of actors working together on Seattle Shakespeare Company's production of Threepenny Opera decided they wanted a different working experience. They knew each other well. They wanted to spend months developing a play. They wanted to self-produce. The result of this conversation was The Seagull Project. Marcy Silman is here for another installment of The Art of Our City.
Yeah, I was curious. Seagull Project, it's not about the seagulls that fly around outside when it's foggy out. We're just looking at our television set. But it's actually going to culminate next week in Anton Chekhov's play, The Seagull. And so I asked John Langs, who directed the play, and Brandon J. Simmons, who I call one of the project instigators, to come to the studio and ask him, like, what the heck is this Seagull Project?
The Seagull Project is 10 actors workshopping a Chekhov play for 9 months.
That's a long time.
Yeah. We really wanted to take the time to be with each other. We wanted to have that natural relationship where I don't have to spend the 3-week rehearsal process figuring out who you are and do I even like you and how do we get along? Do I trust you?
So in a company that might have a repertory group of actors, they have that relationship.
Yeah. Years of experience together.
Well, let's take a step back and talk about the play itself, because I'm sure a lot of people have heard of it and I'm not sure that a lot of people have seen this play. So what's it about?
Well, what it's about is elusive to talk about, because when you do this playwright, I feel like it casts a spell that gets you to a really thick, heightened sort of existential state of thinking about life, you know, life and time and who you are and all of the little, the neurotic things about ourselves and relationships. And there's a web of people pulling on each other through the piece. But when it works, you gather this sort of storm of thickness, emotional thickness in the room, and it just lands in you. So it has, you know, a very thin plot. It's about behavior and relationship. And in its loosest form, you know, a family and an extended family come together on an estate in a very changing time in Russian history where everybody's trying to figure out who they are and what's next. And a friend of mine said recently to me, these plays are about people trying to throw a party and everything that gets in the way of actually allowing that to happen. You know, and there's pretty standard intrigue, a romantic sort of triangle that blossoms a really tortured young man who has this impossible relationship with his mother. It all blows up in their face. And three acts of it are working out these emotional dynamics. And then between act three and four, there's a 2-year break where these people go away, develop as human beings, and come back together. And 2 years later, there is all of those things that had their seeds planted in the first three acts have grown in weight and resonance. And then, you know, they have this final evening where things sort of sum up. So it's a really unique structure. And I think one that I think it's the reason that people approach these plays with such care and sometimes trepidation.
The nonprofit theater world is kind of 4 weeks of rehearsal, mm-hmm. 3 to 4 weeks of performance. There are exceptions to that, but that's kind of how it works. You get a month in the room with everybody working and then a month on stage. Yeah. You've had 9 months of working at least on this. So in terms of what we as an audience might see, what does that give me sitting in the seat?
That space between two actors that you can't describe, that electricity between two actors, that is always possible. It's possible in a 3-week process or a 9-month or a 9-year process, that electricity. You know, that can happen between you and me right now. We're really curious about what happens when you have 9 months. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what our audience will experience when they come and see it. What I'm interested in is a production where the audience leans in and they don't know why they're leaning in and they don't know that they're leaning in, but the play ends and they go, whoa.
As a director, I mean, your job is to help foster what Brandon's talking about, to have us all.
I guess.
Have enough distance from the material to be able to say, we are creating this?
Well, first of all, I think the American theater is in a really crappy place. I mean, to rehearse plays for 4 weeks, and there's nobody who I work for or who I work with that doesn't understand that. It forces actors to rely on tricks. It forces actors to rely on things that work. There's just not enough time to peel the paint, you know, to peel everything that, you know, to get underneath yourself, to get underneath, to go deeper. And these guys have given themselves an opportunity, as Brandon was saying, to really develop the meanings of things. Mm-hmm. So they're vibrating already. There's a great adage that I was sort of brought up with about I don't know, I'm going to blow this. So if you're out there, those critical people who are thinking about, you know, academia, this is going to be inaccurate. However, there's a point. In theater in Japan, there is the idea of training and training for a very long time to become incredibly economic in your work. And there's a story about a wonderful actor who would go up and do this gesture in the No Theater that would be about looking at the moon. And people would admire his skill and say, oh my God, that's a terrific actor. And the master would do the gesture and you would see the moon. And so the goal for us, I think, is to show the moon, you know? And it's so difficult in 4 weeks to get through the push-me-pull-you that makes a show work. And on top of that, just try to find those rich and resonant human experiences that are the thing that we go to the theater for.
Actors, and there are a significant number working in this town, have come together for projects that they have chosen that they are passionate about. This one happens to be classics, but there are any number of actor-driven projects going on right now. And it got me to wondering, was it if you step back from the Seagull project, is it because there's not enough fulfillment in what exists right now, or is it because the system has become so rote? I mean, what is the reason, do you think?
I can't say with any certainty what that reason is, but I do sense that there is a feeling of the actor as the artist, and I'm not the only one. It's so easy to get into that mindset of waiting by the phone. And that's a really disappointing career. The system is problematic, you know, because it is often the case that after 3 weeks, we're not ready. So this experience of, you know, I've had enough of waiting by the phone. There's a whole list of plays I want to do.
It's control a little bit. I mean, I think you're sensing actors who are tired of waiting, you know, and they want to have some control over their own destiny, and they're passionate, and they're artists, and why wait to create?
John Langs and Brandon J. Loomis spoke with Marcy Silman. The Seagull opens January 23rd at ACT Theater, part of the Central Heating Lab. Stay with us. Dow Constantine ahead on weekday.
31 degrees in Seattle with a predicted high today of 41. We still got quite a bit of fog in some areas, but once that's gone, it should wind up mostly sunny.
Support for KU.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.